Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 52 from March 14th, 2008. Air Supply. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/windows. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. It's time for Windows Weekly. Leah Laporte and Paul Thurrott from the fantastic super site for Windows. Well, when you have two R's in your name, you should roll them.
Trill.
Paul Thurrott. He's got two R's and two T's, as if one's not enough for anyone.
That's right.
Paul, how are you today? Feeling better? Is your cold all better, all gone?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm still, but yeah, a million times better than last week. I'm actually really, I've never listened to last week's and maybe never will.
Oh, no, you didn't sound bad. No, you sounded fine.
I must have been delirious.
Well, the content, you mean. Yeah, well, that was insane.
Yeah.
You were nuts.
That was insane.
You were wild. You just kept talking and talking and talking. He couldn't stop. It was all exciting. No, there was a lot to say last week between Mix and everything else that was going on. Today, this week will be a little bit briefer episode, but that's okay, too.
Yeah.
We only talk when we have to.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
Just talk to the sounds of our own voices.
Yeah. I tell you, we didn't really talk about this so much, but I saw a big article in last Sunday's Times, and I thought I'd bring this up. The Microsoft memos about Vista Capable.
Yeah.
Pretty damning.
Well, damning as far as Vista Capable goes, I guess I would say two things. As far as the whole Vista Capable thing goes, and as far as Microsoft having so many different versions of Vista, I've always felt like that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Always. And I've complained about this, from the first moment I heard about it,
This is, let me read you. This is Randall Strauss writing in...
His article, the one you're quoting, is classic. I mean, it's very well constructed, but go on.
Good. Let's deconstruct it if you want.
Okay.
So it is well constructed because he doesn't tell you these memos were released as part of the discovery of a lawsuit brought against Microsoft in 2006, contending that computers labeled Windows Vista capable were in fact incapable of running any version of Windows except the lousy basic version. And Microsoft, so they got these memos as part of the discovery, and internally even Microsoft had the same issue. In fact, it sounds like a lot of people were really unhappy about the standards, how the standards for what Vista capable meant had declined. Initially, they wanted the PCs to be, one of the requirements was PCs would have the graphics to do Aero. And in early 2006, according to these memos, they decided, it's okay.
Right.
And at one point, somebody wrote in one of the emails, a Microsoft program manager said, even a piece of junk qualifies. It'll be a complete tragedy if we allowed it. This is Anantha Concherla who wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
But then what's I think also interesting is the memos from a member of the board of directors and former, COO at Microsoft. We're talking about
Shirley.
John Shirley.
John Shirley, yeah.
Who says, this is after Vista comes out. Who says, I can't run the darn thing because there's no drivers. My printer, my scanner, my film scanner. I've got to keep using XP. The response from another employee, Microsoft employee, is this is the same across the whole ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Mike Nash, a Microsoft vice president overseeing Windows product management, saying I personally got burned. His new laptop cannot run anything but Vista Basic. He says, quote, I now have a $2,100 email machine. I mean, these are people inside Microsoft, very unhappy.
So Mike Nash, I know very well personally. He's a great guy. John Shirley, I'm familiar with just from the historical element. Right. He was a big player in Microsoft's early days.
Yeah, now on the board. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't had an active role in the company for a long, long time. Right. So, I tend to see something different in these emails than most people. And I'm always fascinated by the way people react to this stuff. I think as a reporter, if you're Randall Strauss or, Todd Bishop from the Seattle PI, who's a great guy, has written a lot about
this. Strauss is not really a reporter. He's a business professor at San Jose State.
All right. But he writes for the New York Times.
He writes for the Times on these issues.
Now, it's hard not to look at this and feel like a shark circling prey in the water, right? Because this is, I mean, this is
blood
beautiful.
In the water, baby.
Yeah, I mean, it's just waiting to be plucked, But here's the thing. Now, granted, this stuff didn't come out in a highly transparent manner. It's not like anybody at Microsoft said, "I feel like being credible today. Let me show you the arguments we were having internally over this topic." But, but obviously, it came out as part of a lawsuit. But still, what these emails show is a very healthy dialogue occurring in Microsoft about this feature, about this thing, which I do agree that Microsoft went the wrong direction on, absolutely. But, that smart people argued for what didn't happen, I think should be lauded in some ways, There were guys at Microsoft who had enough credibility to say, look, this is stupid. But Microsoft is also a huge corporation. And they have business partners, the biggest of which is Intel. And Intel wanted to ensure that their, hottest selling integrated graphics chipset wasn't going to be excluded from this Vista wave. And so they basically got Microsoft to agree to change the Vista capable logo program so that chipset was included.
It was Intel's fault. I'm not talking fault.
I mean, but that was why that decision was made. Right. From the standpoint of a user, from the standpoint of someone like me who likes technology and cares about technology, and you, I'm sure, would agree that, they did the wrong thing. But, this shows that there were people at Microsoft who agree with that, and that they were basically hamstrung, that they couldn't do anything about it. They argued that this was the wrong thing to do, but the company went ahead and did it anyway, because in the end, this relationship with Intel is too important to the company.
Right.
And it proves that Microsoft is not this behemoth that can walk over the industry and do whatever they want. I mean, they had to placate Intel. That's how big Intel is.
Okay, that is a different perspective. And I think a reasonable perspective. You're right. I mean, there were a lot of people, according to these emails, who were very unhappy about this. Robin Leonard, who's a Microsoft sales manager, wrote, "It would be a lot less costly to do the right thing for the customer now and to spend dollars on the back end trying to fix the problem."
Which is what they are doing.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd point out, too, is that, a lot of these guys, obviously being, in Mike Nash's case, part of the Windows organization, or John Shirley, shareholder of Microsoft, they want to adopt Windows Vista on day one, but they discovered what a lot of customers discovered over a year ago now, which is that, the driver situation wasn't great. And we've talked about this, and I'd just like to point out once again, Microsoft beat the drum for drivers to these third-party device makers, over and over and over again, and they just didn't show up.
That's the point. I mean, Microsoft doesn't write these.
No.
The companies who make the hardware write them.
It doesn't matter to end users, right? If you are a typical person and you walk into Best Buy and you pick up your copy of Vista the day it comes out, you go home and install it, and all of a sudden, 1, 2, 3, whatever number of hardware devices don't work, and 1, 2, 3, whatever pieces of software that you use regularly don't work, you're not thinking whose fault it is. Right. You're just thinking this thing doesn't work. And this is the same reaction that these guys had. But, Microsoft realizes that people are going to blame them. I mean, saying something like even people at Microsoft were having problems with compatibility when Windows Vista came out is basically an admission that Windows Vista is, in fact, the major new version of Windows that they said it was going to be, because major new versions of Windows always come with compatibility problems. So, what is this really saying? It's saying what they were saying about it all along is true. I realize it's sort of, titillating and it's exciting and it's like, oh, yeah, look, but to me, this is just, this doesn't really say much bad about these guys.
Well, I guess the question should be, who was it at Microsoft greenlighted the idea and bowed to pressure from Intel? And shame on Intel. So they had the GMA 950 chipset. They wanted it to be Vista capable. In fact, I remember I bought a computer with a GMA 950 thinking it was Vista capable.
Right. Well, let's also be fair here, because you know, there is a decent video mode for those machines that emulates Aero. It looks a lot like it. It just doesn't have translucency effects. So, you know, the people who are running Windows Vista Home Basic, or people, if they have appropriate hardware, you know, can actually get a decent graphical experience. Yeah. I mean,
I think the issue really is more that is the driver issue, and just Vista in general requiring more RAM. But that's, as you've pointed out many times, that happens every time there's a new OS. It happened with XP. I'm sure it happened with SE.
It's also worth noting that it's now approximately 15 months later from when these events occurred, and the situation has improved dramatically.
Driver support-wise?
Driver support-wise, application compatibility support-wise,
absolutely. Does SP1 speed Vista up?
Yes, it does.
Ah. I'm waiting for it. I don't know if it's come yet or not.
It hasn't been broadly deployed yet.
So we passed the second Tuesday, so it's not... It's not going to come as a Windows update, will it?
It will, yeah. So sometime in the next 30 days, that's when that's going to.
Okay. And so it won't be necessarily on a patch Tuesday. It might just arrive.
Yeah. In fact, I would expect them to roll it out over time. So I think what will happen is we'll start getting reports that some people say, hey, I woke up this morning and it told me I could install this thing. And that will be the beginning of it.
Right. You know? And now what's your advice? Because remember the horror of XP Service Pack 2.
Yeah, it's nothing like that. In fact, I think the most telling commentary I've seen yet about Service Pack 1 was Microsoft's list of applications that were not compatible compared to the original version of Vista. In other words, this is a list of applications that ran fine on Vista, but no longer run fine on Vista SP1. It was woefully short, and it was a lot of niche kind of esoteric applications, all of which, to this point, have been upgraded now to work.
I mean, it's really old versions of either obscure programs or security programs. Yeah, a lot of security programs. Yeah.
Yep.
So if you've updated, you're going to be fine.
Yes. I think most people, I think we all, not we all, but, you know, statistically, most people at this point are smart enough that, you know, they're connected to the internet. They're leaving Windows Update running in automatic update mode, and critical security fixes are being updated. If you've been sort of doing this as you go along, you've gotten certain performance-oriented updates. You've gotten certain updates that relate to Service Pack 1. And I think the process of moving to Service Pack 1 is going to be pretty clear-cut for those people. I don't think it's going to be a big deal.
Good. So if you get the notice that it's there, go ahead and install.
See, I can't legally say that, Leo. But
it's not legal. You don't want the calls if somebody has problems.
And if it doesn't work, I
I have nothing to do with it.
Do not ever contact me.
Well,
no. I feel that. I think it's going to be a pretty smooth process. Unlike going from XP to Vista, right? It is a major update. You know, I mean, we're talking. You know, people inside of Microsoft had problems with their own devices. You know. Well, God, it was people inside of Microsoft who were complaining that these guys weren't making device drivers, you know? I don't get it. I blogged about this, and I'll just tell this story very quickly. My dad here in Dedham is retired now, but previously worked at the FDIC, which is the federal agency that insures banks. And he was the liaison for the last several years of his career with the FBI, working on interstate bank fraud. And for a while there, he was actually investing in high tech companies. And he would talk to me about this. And he was a terrible investor because, you know, Intel, he would invest in Intel. They would make a big announcement. Their stock would go up. He was ecstatic. And then AMD would make an announcement. Intel stock would nosedive the next day and he would freak out. I don't think it was the right kind of investment for him. But I was discussing with him a decade or more ago, the Microsoft antitrust trial. And a lot of the similar kind of emails that were coming up at the time, right? Remember, somebody said, you know, we're going to cut off Netscape's air supply. And, you know, of course, Jim Altman infamously went on into court and gave the demo that people eventually figured out had been rigged in some way. And
a lot of that stuff. Yeah.
It was very controversial at the time. And my dad basically said, hey, you know, you're not looking at this the right way. When an executive of a corporation that you own shares in says that he wants to cut off the air supply of a competitor, that's exactly the kind of language you want to hear from that person. That's the kind of language you expect from someone who is representing your money. And he said, this kind of stuff should be required and cheered, not discussed in this fashion.
Greed is good.
Yeah, well, it is when you're talking about your money. I mean, he said, unless the company is acting illegally, which right. of course is in some ways.
And cut off your air supply, it sounds like it might be acting illegally, but okay. You're right. No, you want him to be aggressive. You love Steve Ballmer because he's aggressive.
Exactly. And by the way, one of the big complaints I've had about Microsoft in the intervening years is that they've really calmed down. They don't get out there a lot and say, we're going to go after market share. We're going to go after this company. We're going to make them pay for, you know, what they did to us or what they said about us. And I think that there is a place for aggressiveness in corporations. And I it's been sad watching them get sort of emasculated over the past decade, because Microsoft is a company, I think, that unfortunately it's huge and it's all over the place. And I think they're at their best when they're acting aggressively. Obviously, you don't want them to cross the line and engage in illegal behavior. But as long as they're not doing that, I think they should be as aggressive as they can be within the confines of the law.
All right.
All right.
I'll accept that.
Now, well, it was good talking to you this week.
Now, let's talk about Windows Home Server.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, we were very excited when we first heard about this. I know you were a judge for plugins and stuff, and it really looked to be a very easy, simple way for Windows users to, you know, run network-attached storage and do a lot of cool things, have home servers. But it's turning out not to be quite as reliable, maybe, as you'd like.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd have you'll have to remind me. I know we've talked about this a little bit, but, you know, some of the issues I had with Windows Home Server, I mean, way, way back before I had the product, you know, back when I just talked to the team about what they were doing, was that it seemed like they were implementing certain technologies on their own, you know, and one of those that I recall is the technology that's getting them in trouble now, which is their data duplication technology, you know, so that if you have a file on the server, you can choose to ensure that a backup copy is made of that file on a different hard disk. So if there's a hard disk error, if there's a hardware error, you won't lose the file because it's been copied to two different places, two different physical locations. And, you know, Microsoft already has technologies that do this. They have technologies created by Microsoft Research, implemented already on their server products that are designed for this purpose. There's also things like RAID, right? Which is admittedly complex, but you know, it seems like these problems had been solved already, but they went and kind of did their own thing. And I remember the conversation I had was, you know, why, I don't understand. You're a kind of a small group off the side of the server team and you're doing your own thing. And aren't you worried that, you know, this is going to cause some problems?
Right.
And it has caused some problems. So, you know, the data corruption error that was first, that first came to light back in December, you know, here we are, it's March, it's 4 months later. This problem has still not been fixed. I've been sort of, you know, prodding them a little bit. You know, you need to discuss this. You know, what's going on? Time is going by. And basically this week they just, they posted about it. But they don't have a fix. They probably won't have one until June. And they have some recommendations, which are sort of the same as the recommendations we've already seen, where basically what they're saying is, you know, don't edit data directly stored on the server. Edit it locally on your own PC and then copy the data back up to the server.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that.
Yeah.
You know, so what's ironic is Apple had a very similar cross-network copying bug.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. Identical, in fact. And the advice was exactly the same.
Okay.
The workaround, I guess I should say.
Yeah. So now the stories are appearing. You know, people are saying, hey, maybe this thing is a lemon. This might be the, you know, the worst product of the year. You know, people are going to have to, you know, avoid Windows Home Server. And I still feel like Windows Home Server is a cool product. I'm going to keep using it. I don't edit things on the server anyway. I use it as a kind of a dump. You know, I throw stuff up there when I'm done with it. So if I'm working on an article that will be published in the future, that's on my PC. Once it's been completed, that's when I copy the whole folder of all the material I have up to the server. So this just happens to fit the way that I work. I acknowledge that other people may work differently, and this may be a tougher issue for them. I think the bigger problem, though, is that this is already a product that's kind of a tough sell, right? You really have to explain it to somebody why they need something like this.
Right. If they understand it, then they're probably already using a NAS.
They might already have
something. Running Linux.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Windows Home Server has enough unique value because obviously it does other things as well. But it doesn't lend itself to a one-sentence quickie sell job. And it's not something you can very quickly explain to someone and have them say, yes, you're right, I do want to spend $500 on this thing. And now when you tack on this data corruption issue that has not been fixed months down the road, and now they're even delaying the next update to Windows Home Server, the PowerPack 1 release, which includes additional functionality and x64 compatibility and other things, this thing is not going to ship now until this data corruption issue is fixed. We're talking 6-7 months.
But, for years, everybody, I always said anyway, never use anything for Microsoft version 1.0.
That's right.
Right? This just confirms that. I mean, and in fact, it happens again and again.
Yeah, it really does.
Version 2, or better yet, version 3. It happened with Internet Explorer. And by the time Microsoft gets to version 3 of anything, they own it. IE3 killed Netscape, basically.
Yep. Sure. Yeah, Windows was the joke until version 3.
This is version, Windows 1. Come on. That wasn't even, I don't know what it was. It was a shell. So I guess you could just say, well, look, it's version 1 of Windows Home Server. Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Is that unique to Microsoft, though? I think a lot of tech products, version 1 is weak.
You know, it could be. I don't know that it matters, because the problem with Microsoft is that they're Microsoft. So, their stuff is popular. There's, right. Even though Windows Home Server and NAS servers and home backup solutions are relatively niche solutions for consumers, Microsoft, just by entering the market, lends it some credibility, and they get many, many users. So
now they tested it for a long time. So, I mean, I guess that's their response to that as well. Yeah, we know as soon as we put a product out, we're going to sell millions. So we're going to try to test with millions before we release.
I guess so. But I find the long delays, the heavy silence around this to be very, very disturbing.
They're not good at that. They need to work on that part. Transparency.
Microsoft can be very transparent, but it's amazing how they clam up when something goes wrong.
Maybe that's it. Yeah.
The Internet Explorer guys did this with IE8, for a year. They said nothing about it, and it took a shareholder at their annual shareholders meeting to stand up and say to Bill Gates, hey, you guys talk about how transparent you are. You haven't even mentioned this thing. When are you going to start talking about it? That's what transparency is. Right. You can't just ignore it.
Of course, Microsoft's nothing compared to Apple in that regard.
Yeah, and right. That's actually
prudent, I think, for a company to. Transparency is great, and I'm a big fan of transparency, and I believe in it absolutely and act that way. But it also is prudent for a tech company not to pre-announce, not to overpromise. And, I think
through my haze of sickness last week, I believe we might have talked about this a little bit. Microsoft, in some ways, especially in the enterprise, one could argue is required to be transparent about their roadmap. Obviously, you want to.
Right. We did talk about that. Yes.
Yeah. It sounds familiar. Yeah. Apple is the opposite. So, I think there's a happy medium on the consumer end. I think they need to be more transparent. And by the way, the best time to be transparent is when something goes wrong.
When there's a problem. Look at Elliot Spitzer.
Oh, jeez. Yes, let's look at Elliot Spitzer.
Now let's look away real quick.
What a car crash.
Moving. Oh. But, to his credit, he didn't pull a Bill Clinton, probably having learned from Bill Clinton. He immediately just said, yeah, I'm sorry.
All you have to do is look at the guy's wife's face to realize that the rest of his life is going to be absolutely miserable. Deservedly so.
But he acted, I think, in the only way you can, which is to say, fall on your sword, instead of going through this merry-go-round of denial. And I think that's probably what Microsoft should do. Boy, is that a stretch. if it's got a buggy system, admit it, act promptly to fix it. Don't hide it.
Well, this is maybe a side topic, but Microsoft would argue that they are very transparent. I think what I would say is they appear to be. at a very high level. But, you know, when they don't want to talk about stuff like IE8 or this Windows Home Server data corruption issue, they can be very non-transparent. And I'm sorry, you know, being transparent about nothing is meaningless. You have to be transparent about everything.
Well, okay, because I am transparent about nothing. I'll tell you what I had for breakfast.
No, right, of course. But if something was going wrong in your life, we would probably know about that as well.
Yeah, you would.
That's true transparency.
Yeah, you would.
Right. You can't just pick and choose. You know, you can't say, well, everything's going fine, so I'll discuss.
Well, I'll give you an example. Perhaps you've heard me typing in the background. You hear those, you hear this loud clicking. Yeah. That's because now I have I'm using my backup keyboard.
It's like the targeting system on the Apollo moon landing.
It is. No, I was foolish. I went out and bought, you know, remember the great old IBM keyboards with the really tactical feel? But the problem with the tactical feel, the problem with them is they're loud. They have those buckling springs in them. And when but writers especially like them because you bang on them.
Plus, you sound like Woodward and Bernstein over there, you know.
Copy! The problem with it is, if you're doing a podcast, everybody can hear every click, or a radio show every click. So I bought this great tactile keyboard. I love it, from Matthias. But now I had to put it aside because it's so clicky. So I was using an Apple keyboard, which was mushier. But the keyboards, especially when, as I do, you are at the keyboard all day and perhaps eating meals at the keyboard. Yes. You know, you're just using it all the time. They get really disgusting very fast. Mm-hmm. So I put my keyboard in the dishwasher.
Oh, wait a minute. I just want to be clear about what we're talking about. What kind of keyboard is this?
Well, this one is a Matthias Tactile Pro. I washed it first because I thought, well, this is the noisy one. So I thought, well,
put this in the dishwasher.
In the automatic dishwasher with dishes and dish detergent. Ran it through a cycle. Now, the key on this is you got
to
really dry
it. I would never
it.
Do that to the keyboard I use, but it's only because it's a plastic piece of junk and it would probably...
No, that's the perfect one to do it because if you lose it, big deal.
Yeah, that's true.
So I did that to this, and it came through with flying colors. I actually had the other reason I wasn't using this keyboard is because the N key had stopped working because there was a piece of bread or something lodged under it.
That's awesome because you know the 3 on my phone doesn't work, so I can't dial numbers that
don't do it with a phone. But the key
it's like a Stephen Wright joke. You know, I can't write every article I want. I don't have an N on my keyboard.
So the real key is to let it dry completely. You know, for like a week before you attempt to use it. Because if it's fully dry and it was just water, it's going to be okay. You think?
This sounds dicey to me.
Well, I'll only do it because keyboards are cheap. You can always get another one. Only do it with a keyboard you don't mind if it fails.
I don't know what you call this, but what you just said sounds logical to me. But then if you handed me my keyboard and said, now go put this in the dishwasher, I don't think I would be able to
do
that.
It's a little uncomfortable, and I have to say, when my wife and children opened the dishwasher and there's my keyboard,
right?
They thought I'd lost my marbles.
Yeah.
But you know what? It worked on this one. It's fresh and clean. I mean, can you smell the downy fresh?
I can't actually smell anything yet, but I believe you.
It's really nice. So I just watched the other one. It's drying, so I might be a little noisy during this show because I'm using the Tactile Pro. Instead of, I think Northgate?
Yes, that's what that sounds right. Yeah, the old Selectric style or whatever.
Oh, man, those are
great. The original IBM PC style keyboards. Yeah.
And if I had no, you know, if I weren't doing broadcasting, I would be using those. I love it. But you can't. It's really noisy.
It sounds, I'm waiting for you to, you know, the old typewriters with the arm you had to swing over to, you know, push the thing back.
I love
at the end
that.
Of each line.
Somebody should make a keyboard that does that. It doesn't do anything, but it just sting. Just as satisfying.
I've seen, sound effects for keyboards. So as you type, it actually comes out through the speaker. That's
Anyway, that's transparency. I'm admitting to putting my keyboards. Now, I'm not going to do it with the mice or anything else, but the keyboards seem to come through with flying colors. Windows Media Extender. Now, we were talking about that last week, or maybe it was a couple of weeks ago.
I'm not sure.
What is Windows Media Extender?
Well, you know, Microsoft has had this Windows Media Center software in Windows, for a few years now. Right. Several versions. There's a version in Vista that is badly in need of an update, but it's there.
Yes.
And in the Windows XP timeframe, they had Windows Media Extenders, which were hardware devices where you could sort of extend the Windows Media user interface over to the TV. So you'd plug this device and it looked like a pizza box. It had standard TV connections on it. It would communicate back to your PC over the home network, preferably over wired network at the time. And you could sort of get a pseudo media center experience because, you know, obviously the hardware in these devices wasn't very good, so you couldn't do all the beautiful transitions and things. And but you could get it. You could get your photos out there, your music out there, videos.
It's an interface, really, right, more than anything else.
Yeah. So, you know, a little bit of a complex setup, but if you did have a computer set up so that it was interacting with a cable set-top box, you could record shows onto the TV, and then you could have these extenders around your house, up to five of them, and you could be sitting up in your bedroom, over in your den, or whatever, with a remote control, and you could watch these TV shows. You could watch live TV, you could watch recorded TV, all over the network, because there'd only be that one connection coming into your house over at the cable box. And, you know, it's always been a little dicey. It kind of worked. They released a software package for the original Xbox that you could have this extender software on the Xbox. That was, you know, okay. Now, the big deal, of course, is you want this to work with Windows Vista. And until very recently, the only extender available for Windows Vista was the Xbox 360. So there's kind of a good and bad thing there, because the Xbox 360 is powerful enough that the extender experience is one-to-one. It has all the transitions. It has all the beautiful kind of effects, you know, the visual effects that Media Center has on Windows Vista.
Now, is it a download for Xbox, or does it come with the Xbox software?
No, it's built right in. It's built right in.
I haven't played with that much. I guess most of it
works
Windows
well.
Machine at home.
I'm sorry.
I don't have a Windows machine at home, so.
Yeah. So for a long, long time, we actually used an Xbox 360 in our living room as our primary TV interface. You know, the PC in my office had Media Center on it. It was recording TV shows. You could transmit live TV shows over the network. It worked fine.
Neat.
It's neat, but the problem is the Xbox 360 is so loud. It's such a lousy thing to have in your living room, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the software interface was wonderful, perfect. The hardware was lousy. So the hope is, a year ago at CES, not this past year, but a year ago, they announced a new family of Media Center extender devices and software that would be in devices that were going to come out in time for last Christmas. They never did. They're just starting to come out now. So there are standalone devices, just like they were last time. There are versions that have built-in DVD players, which was one of the complaints about the previous generation. And then they're building it into set-top boxes and into TVs from certain manufacturers. So in the near future, you'll be able to buy an HP TV set. And one of the interfaces built right in will be this Media Center extender. So you can connect it to your you know, your Vista-based PC over in the home office. So I've been really excited to try these things. And mostly because I get so much email about, you know, people, I know there are people out there that want these, and the old extenders aren't going to be upgradable to Vista, et cetera. So Microsoft sent me some stuff a few months ago, and they sent me a Linksys device. It was the real, kind of the bare bones small version, really small box, kind of Apple TV sized kind of deal, similar connections. It's similar to the old extenders, unfortunately. The performance is slower than I liked. The interface was kind of muddy and, you know, didn't have any of the transition effects or any of the 3D visual effects and all that. And Microsoft told me that the reason was that, you know, the hardware in there just isn't that good. I mean, there's not much you can do about that stuff. But, you know, it seemed to kind of work, but it stopped working after a couple of days. So they sent me a replacement unit, and this one was the next version up. It has the DVD player built in. But, you know, again, same performance problems. And now I'm thinking to myself, geez, I've been waiting for years to write about this thing, and now it's here, and it's terrible, and I don't know what to do. Plus, you know, the Apple TV had just come out with the update, the Take Two update.
Although, ironically, the Take Two update is uglier, slower than the original Apple TV.
It is a world of difference compared to these extenders. I mean, it's much better than the extenders.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was kind of in a weird position because I will be, in fact, reviewing these things. I think that the software interface is very good. I think that the Linksys hardware, both of them, are horrible. I mean, it's horrible. So bad that I cannot recommend anyone buy either one of these things.
They cut corners, I would guess.
I don't know what it is. But what I've been told by someone outside of Microsoft, by a person that I trust very much, who's involved with cable companies and set-top boxes and devices, is that D-Link is coming out with an update to their Media Center extender that will be the same generation. It's just shipping to the United States this week. She has a pre-release version of it. The performance is dramatically better than any of the Linksys stuff. So I'm going to basically wait until I have this D-Link. I've ordered one. And you know, to review all this stuff, and hopefully it will live up to what she's described. But I guess my sort of in midstream thought on this is, if you're looking at an extender, do not buy any Linksys device. They're terrible. I'll let you know about the D-Link. And then I know that the Xbox 360 works very well. The question is going to be whether or not the loudness of the device is too much of a problem for you. It is for me. But then I don't have any of the, you know, the very newest Xbox 360s. I know they've been getting a little bit quieter over time. So it's possible if you have an Xbox 360 Elite, which is the black unit, or one of the newer units from the last holiday season, it might be acceptable. But as of right now, I guess what I'm saying is you need to stay away from these things.
Stay well away.
They're just not any good.
That's disappointing. The idea is good, and the idea is right, and it is going to happen. There's just no question in my mind it's going to happen.
I just don't understand why it's taken so long. Plus, you wait this long, and then it's just as lousy as it ever was. Right. It's just sad.
I think hardware designers are not as advanced as software designers.
Yeah, I think there's a mentality out there, too. You know, they really cut corners wherever they can, and it's sort of like that Vista capable thing. You know, what's the bare minimum? You know, we want to put these bits up on the screen. What's the cheapest piece of plastic we can use to make that happen? And they really go for it, you know.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah. Bad. Well, they don't want to spend a lot of money on what are the prices for these things?
Well, that's the thing; they're expensive too.
Oh,
The Linksys devices, I bet, are $250-$300 depending on which one you get.
They shouldn't be. That's more than the Apple TV.
Well, that's as much as an Xbox 360 too.
Right. So your recommendation would be, if you don't have an Xbox 360, get one of those instead.
Or wait for the D-Link. You know.
Yeah.
If the sound is a concern. And, you know, it is for me. I don't know how you would test this, unfortunately. But Xbox 360s are loud. You know, it's just the sad truth. So
let's talk about Redfly. Because, you know, I was very disappointed when Palm killed the Folio. That was going to be for Trios. Kind of like a keyboard and full screen, bigger screen for that. Would a Trio, you'd use a Trios internet connection. It'd be a connection. They killed it, and then Asus comes along with the EPC, and it sells 500,000 in a week.
Right.
People clearly want these small, inexpensive computers.
There is a market for this thing, yeah.
Yeah, I bought it. And now I'm kicking myself because they announced one with a bigger screen, of course.
Yeah, I know. I saw that, too. I really was looking forward to the Folio.
Me, too. When I saw it, I was very excited. And I was very disappointed they killed it.
Yeah, I sort of understand why they did, because one of the things I think maybe they got wrong on the Folio was they created a new platform. You know, they went with Linux, they did their own thing, they had to spend a lot of time working on software that would, you know, allow you to grab stuff over on the Palm, bring it over, display it in Linux. You know, you could change it, save it, and then copy it back, you know. And it was kind of it might have been a little too complex. I think. And I think that was the rationale. I remember when they canceled it, some of the language they used said, you know, we're going to focus on this Palm platform, and working on something separate just doesn't make sense. It's not a good use of our time and resources.
Well, you know, Cobalt, Palm OS 6 has been way delayed. They really need to do that, because Palm now looks like, you know, 1980s technology compared to Windows Mobile and for the iPhone.
It would be like if the Mac OS had never gotten color.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the Palm OS is so ancient looking. I mean, it's
exactly. Just, so they really do need to update it.
Yeah, they really do. But so what we have now on the Windows Mobile side is something called Redfly from a company called Celio.
Now, this is interesting.
I really feel like there's a place for something like this. If you think about the Folio and imagine a version of that for different Windows Mobile devices, and they're going to be expanding this to other Windows Mobile devices and then also to other non-Windows Mobile devices.
So if I have, a Sprint Mogul, I would plug this in, some USB, into this little laptop?
Yeah, so it works over USB or over Bluetooth.
Oh, okay.
Right. You can, you know, synchronize them that way. One of the things that's neat about Bluetooth is that you could be sitting in, you know, a coffee shop or wherever you are.
Your phone could be in your backpack.
Your phone could be in your pocket, your briefcase, wherever. Open this little mini laptop looking thing. It synchronizes right up.
Does it get internet access through the phone too?
Yeah, it does everything. It is the phone transmitted to the device.
So it has the phone's UI and everything.
It has whatever the phone provides.
Ah.
So All it really is a screen, you know, and some kind of a BIOS, obviously, to handle the connections. But there's nothing, there's no OS running on this device. So it's very small, lightweight, gets 8 hours of battery life. It only weighs about 2 pounds.
It'll charge your phone, keyboard. I see, if you plug it in via USB.
If you plug it in, right, it will charge your phone.
That's neat.
Yeah. So what's neat about Windows Mobile specifically, I guess, is that it essentially resets the device. So when the device comes back to, awake, it says, oh, I've got this big screen attached. Let's make sure it looks good on the screen, because that's how Windows Mobile works. So
now you haven't tried one, so we don't know how well it works under Bluetooth.
Exactly. Yeah. So I haven't tried one. And this is based on, I had read about this. I contacted the company. I knew I was going to be traveling a lot, so I wanted to talk to them after I got back, and talked to them the other day. And sometime over the next month, they're going to hook me up with a unit and a smartphone so I can test it. But I wanted to throw this out here because I've always thought that the Folio thing was a good idea. I understand the complexities of what they were trying to do and why they got rid of it. And it wouldn't surprise me to discover that Palm does their own thing, or maybe even works with Celio in the future, because I really feel like there's a market for this. Because you travel a lot. I travel. I mean,
I don't want
to.
This is what I want.
Yeah, I would love to be able to have, something small and light. And there are certain realities of what I do for a living. I mean, I do write for a living, so I couldn't use this solely currently. But
is the keyboard big enough? You could type, right? I mean, you could do some writing.
Yeah.
But people want to do email. They want to do, Twitter. They want to do email. They want to do maybe surf the web.
Right.
Simple stuff, which this would do great.
Work on Word documents, work on Excel documents. Yeah. All that stuff should work fine. So
this works with the Tilt and the Mogul. Those would be two good choices. Interestingly, it also works with the Trio 700W.
Which is the Windows Palm. Mobile version.
Yeah.
But running Windows Mobile.
Right. It's the Samsung SCH i760, which is a really nice phone. I like the i760 a lot.
Yeah.
And HTC's XV6800, the 6800 from Verizon. So that's a pretty good set of good. These are the powerful Windows Mobile devices, the ones you'd want anyway, because they have many of them have keyboards.
Right.
So that's the question. Do you need, if you already have a Mogul and you have a keyboard, do you need this? I think you do. You want the bigger screen.
I think you do. Yeah. If you're the traveling executive type, and you might have a PowerPoint, Excel spreadsheet, something like that.
I'm tempted. Screen. I would be tempted. I kind of have. I'm not had a happy Windows Mobile guy. I'm a BlackBerry guy, an iPhone guy.
Yeah.
But I would be. I like the 760. I'd be tempted to get a 760, and this Redfly. How much does a Redfly?
I want to say it's $500.
Ooh. The Folio was going to be $400.
I think it's somewhere.
These things are expensive. That's what the EPC is. They're kind of pricey. Sure. I want $200 bucks. You got me.
Sure. But I think that the big market for this in the beginning is going to be in corporations. Companies that are going to buy a bunch of these.
Right.
And I need to see it, but I like the idea. I at this point, I just want to throw it out there. If you're a Windows Mobile guy, this is definitely something to check out.
Very interesting. Wow. Yeah. Palms might be kicking themselves a little bit here. Looking at the Asus, the success of the Asus, and now this?
I think they did the right thing. I think that the idea of the Folio is a good one. Putting Linux, doing their own OS kind of thing, I think was too much.
Yeah.
And that's when you look at this and say, well, this is how you could have done
it. Much simpler. So I'm looking now at the PC Mag review. It's $500, 800 by 480 screen.
Yep.
That's a problem I have with the Asus. That's the size of the Asus, too. And most websites are designed for 1024 by...
Yeah, sure. No, you're still browsing the web with, the mobile version of Internet Explorer, Pocket IE, whatever they call it. I mean, it's not going to be a great experience per se. But again, the idea is just to get stuff up bigger. The email experience is supposed to be very good on this. What did they rate? Did they rate this device? Did they give it a rating?
Let's see. This is Sasha Segan writing. It doesn't look like this is more. This is a first look. This is from their CES coverage, not a full review.
Yeah, so they must have come out at CES just to kind of show it off.
Yeah. They say ship date right around now.
Yeah. Sometime in March. That was.
Yeah. Totally. So these guys didn't review it either. They didn't have a hands on. Okay. Let's get one for you, Paul. I want to get a hands on review of this.
Okay.
Redfly. That's the goal. Celio Corp. CelioCorp.com. Mm-hmm. I just got yesterday the new Firefox beta 4 of Firefox 3. I understand from the Mozilla folks that this probably is the release candidate. They're very close to releasing Firefox 3.
Yeah, it seems so, yeah.
I like it. I've been using it since beta 2. I like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, with the caveat that we had discussed previously.
It's not native. It's not native.
Well, yeah, they were going to do the native UI thing, but that's not happening. The UI is, you know, whatever. It's fine. I mean,
when does IE8 come out?
Supposedly late this year.
So that's going to be a way to go. It's because of the standard support. Mm-hmm. I think IE7 is absolutely as secure as Firefox now, especially on Vista with that special security mode.
Yeah, I would say so.
I would be happy using IE8 if it were, mm-hmm. you know, completely standards compliant. So maybe right. It's funny because Internet Explorer put Netscape out of business, essentially. When they came out with a free 3.0, Netscape's model of selling the browser just kind of flopped on them. They ended up selling to AOL, and AOL killed Netscape a couple of weeks ago. They stopped developing it. It's open source brother, Firefox. Having some problems with version 2. Now it's out in version 3. And could history repeat itself with IE8 killing Firefox 3?
I don't think so. I think that there is enough of an audience for Firefox that, you know, they're going to be around for a while. It's tough because, you know, I complain about certain things in Firefox, but you have to understand where this is coming from. I mean, I'm a heavy user of Firefox. If you check out Wakupa, you can see, I mean, it's one of my top most frequently used applications. It's a big part of my daily life, you know, my daily work life. And it's a mature product, and it's getting a little harder, I think, to come out with innovative new features, you know. And in fact, one of the things I've been a little distressed by this past week is, you know, how quickly a couple of the guys over at Mozilla have run to copy features that Microsoft announced for IE8. You know, almost in a vain bid to prove that, you know, anything they can we can just duplicate it, you know, immediately. And that's cute. But, you know, that's one of the reasons I don't like something like Linux. I feel like those guys spend way too much time copying Mac OS X and Windows instead of just doing their own innovative, unique thing.
Right.
And that's always been one of the nice things about Firefox. So, you know, they're not going to do the customized UI that works properly on or looks beautiful on each environment. That's too bad. But I can't say on the positive note, and you can see this in beta 4, you know, Firefox now uses a lot less memory than it used to. And this was a huge problem for Firefox 2. I could leave this thing running overnight and it would be consuming half a gigabyte of RAM. And I've never seen it go above 60 megabytes since I've installed beta 4. So maybe 60, 70, somewhere. That's
a big difference. That was that pre-caching, I think. They were pre-fetching pages.
They've fixed memory holes, but they've also fixed or changed,
behaviors changed.
Dramatically. Yeah. And you can really see it. So,
does it slow down browsing? I mean, the idea of pre-fetching pages was when you click on a link, it pops up because it's already there.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know.
I think it's net unfriendly, too, because you're downloading a lot of stuff you're never going to look at.
Yeah. Yeah. In my experience, I mean, I don't know if it's the connection I have or, you know, what is the reason, but no, I mean, when I browse around in Firefox 3, things seem to pop up just like they did before.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think they're fine.
Don't like the UI. I don't mean to run that. The new user interface is awful. It's just awful.
I agree. It's not great, but because of the extensions, because of new features like the smart bookmarks feature, the quick searches feature, I'm kind of willing to put up with that because I do like the functionality a lot.
Yes. There's no doubt about it. I played around with IE for a while there. I was kind of losing the religion, so to speak.
You get hooked on Firefox extensions. I mean, I think that's the smartest thing they ever did, because once you get hooked on it, you cannot use another browser. You know, I rely on these little doohickeys I've got going.
Well, it's one thing to release a system where people can make extensions, but it has to be supported by actual extensions. And that's one of the beauties of this open source model they have, or whatever it is.
Big community.
There's a huge community of people that love this browser and want to support it. And God help you if you're trying to combine two things. You know, I use Flickr stuff on the web. I wish there was some, you know, add-in for my browser. Well, guess what? There is. There are a million of them, and they're all on Firefox, you know. And that's neat, so... I think that's a big thing they've been able to do very successfully.
Let's take a break for our Audible commercial, and then we're going to come back. You're going to have a tip of the week and software of the week. Audible, of course, is the my place to go for your audio books. There are lots of places you can get audio books. Of course, you can get them from the publisher in the bookstore for a lot of money and usually abridged. You can get them at the library, but they have a very small selection. The beauty of Audible is a huge selection, 45,000 plus titles, hundreds of titles added every day. And instead of, I mean, they have the publisher abridged versions if you really want them. And I think sometimes for nonfiction, that's fine. But they also have unabridged versions read not by the author, who sometimes is not the best reader. Sometimes when their author is a good reader, they'll be read by the author, but always invariably by somebody who really can read. And that makes a difference in an audiobook. It engages you. It makes you want to listen. You feel like somebody's telling you a story, and it's so great. We have a special deal. If you go to audible.com/windows, you can sign up for Audible and get a coupon, a credit toward a free book. And we like to recommend every show. We like to recommend something. I've been doing some thrillers. What do you got this week? What have you been listening to?
Well, as I'm sure you know, the Dungeons & Dragons co-creator, Gary Gygax, had passed away this past week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, like many
Were you a Dungeons & Dragons guy?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean,
This isn't, we're not talking a computer game. We're talking going to the back of a comic book shop and you roll 20-sided die. And, you know, and you have a dungeon master who tells you what's going on. Sometimes you'll have tokens in a board, but
it's amazing that I have been married for almost 20 years.
That's amazing. You got anybody to date you.
Curiously, Dungeons & Dragons is not a chick magnet.
No. But it is fun, anyway. Engrossing and addictive. I understand completely.
Yeah. You know, I think as a kid growing up, especially when your imagination's going wild, I mean, I latched on to certain types of books. And in this game, I think, was a big part of that. And I was looking for something along those lines. And what I discovered was that Tolkien's latest and possibly last book, The Children of Húrin, has been put onto Audible and narrated by Christopher Lee.
Oh, Sauron.
Right, who played Saruman. In the movies, right? So this is a great story. If you're, you know, as sort of a Dungeons & Dragons / Tolkien geek from way back, I've already read different versions of the story because one appeared in the Silmarillion back in the late 1970s, and then a more complete version of it appeared in Unfinished Tales. Which is one of the many books that his son had published after Tolkien's death over the past, you know, few decades. But this book is basically the most complete version of the story, and it is the story that Tolkien was working on after he completed The Lord of the Rings.
Is it the same place?
Same universe, yeah. Okay. It takes place in an earlier time. It involves the people who and the elves and so forth who are fighting against the precursor to Sauron, who's the enemy in The Lord of the Rings. This is the basically a god who turned, you know, evil as in the Bible, I guess, and was Sauron's, you know, boss or whatever, let's say, you know, in the early of millennia.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a great story. And, you know, like The Lord of the Rings, I would say as far as, you know, readability, if you've read any of the Tolkien stuff, you know that some of the older stuff like the Silmarillion can be a little tough to get through.
Really tough.
Yeah. I mean, it's like reading an ancient text, literally. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this is much more readable than that. It's much more like The Lord of the Rings. Not quite there, but it's much, you know, I'd say more toward The Lord of the Rings than toward the Silmarillion from sort of a readability
standpoint.
And I tell
you, when you get somebody like Christopher Lee reading it, well, let me play a little bit of Christopher Lee, because he's going to bring it to life. You know, he's got
he's
that
amazing
voice and that style. And
her love was given to trees and to the flowers of the wild, and she was a singer and a maker of songs. Oh. 2 months only.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm putting that on my wish list right now. Oh, that sounds great. That sounds, and it's full. I mean, it's a full novel. It's 7 hours.
It's 61
minutes.
Yeah, unabridged. Yep.
The Children of Húrin, H-U-R-I-N. That's our book this week. Paul, you came up with a good one. I thought we'd done everything. we've done everything on the
all over the map. All
over the map. Beauty of Audible. There's, you know, end of stuff. So if you'd like to get that book free, all you do is go to audible.com/windows, sign up. You must be a new member, and you'll get a credit toward a free book. And that the hardest thing is choosing. That's why we like to do these little mini book reports, help you choose. Mm-hmm. Great stuff. Thank you. Audible.com. I don't know what I'd do without you. I had to do a lot of driving this past through a few days. It's the cure for road rage, I tell you. I don't mind if there's traffic. It's like, yeah, I'll slow down. I'm really engrossed in this book.
Yep.
All right, let's, I think, a tip of the week. Time for a tip of the week. What do you got for us there? Our St. Patrick's Day tip of the week.
I was going to say, it's slipped into...
It is. Because, you know, it's only a few days to St. Patrick's Day.
you're reminding me of... I'm sorry, you're just reminding me of one of my neighbors.
They're magically delicious.
There's a guy up the street who...
he talks like that?
Yes, and doesn't clean his... he uses his fireplace to heat the house.
Oh, dear. Well, we so go he, out and we get little Pete from
he,
the bar.
He had a house fire. He told a friend of mine, he said, my friend asked him, why don't you just clean the thing? You know, you can clean it every winter, every spring. Right. And he says, why should I clean it when the town of Dedham will do it for me? You know, because the fire trucks had to come and, yeah.
Fire department will do it.
A little bit of Irish,
you know, Irish humor kind there. Of,
logic there. I don't know. Anyway. I just thought that was good. So, on a completely unrelated note, the Vista tip of the week is about integrated search, which we might have talked about a little bit, but of course, this has changed in Service Pack 1. So, just wanted to go over this again in the event that you've installed Service Pack 1 and you're wondering where it went, or because it's such a hidden feature anyway, you know, it might be something that you're unaware of. Because back when I was working on the Windows Vista Secrets book, way back when, I'm talking over 2 years ago, I tried to start writing. And one of the first things I wanted to write about was this integrated search feature, because this was the big new thing. You know, there's going to be WinFS in a file system. You're going to have save folder or save searches as sort of special folders in the file system that were going to replace documents and pictures and music. It was going to be a big deal. And it was really stupid of me to do this, because I wrote this chapter, and then Microsoft proceeded through the course of the beta to change this feature again and again and again until now. If you look at Vista, you would think, my God, it's just like XP. They really haven't changed the file system at all. When in fact, there is this stuff going on behind the scenes, but it's so well hidden.
Ah.
You almost don't even know it's there. And in Service Pack 1, it's even worse, because when you open the start menu, the search item is gone.
Right.
So there are things you can do. To bring up the search window, if you don't have Service Pack 1, you can just click on that search item that's on the right side of the start menu. But if you do have Service Pack 1, there's no way to bring it back. But if you open the start menu, you can hit the F3 key, and that will bring up that search results window, and it allows you to do a search.
Oh, that's ridiculous. So instead of having it in the menu, you just have to hit F3.
Right.
Which has always been the search key anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you can also launch a global search by doing, if you have a Windows key on your keyboard, you can do Windows key plus F
right
from any place, and that will open up your the search window as well.
Right.
Now, typically, you might want to do a search from a specific location, and if that's the case, you can open up the documents folder, the pictures folder, whatever. The search box will be there in the Explorer window. I think we did discuss this fairly recently. It's up there in the upper
right
corner, and you can type a search. And when you do that kind of a search, it's going to be context sensitive to the location that you're at. So if you search from the documents folder, the search results are going to be from the documents folder. And then, of course, from all the subfolders underneath.
So. It says that. It says search in the current view. If you were looking at search results, could you search the search results that way?
Yeah. You could actually find. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you could find.
That would be very handy, actually.
Yeah, but they also, it would be, but you know, they also give you other ways to do more fine-tuned searches. You could see that advanced search button that appears. Right. If you click that, it brings up a sort of a fold-down pane that has all kinds of different ways to hone the search. And you can also search by specific document types, like email, documents, pictures, music, etc. There's all kinds of, you know, different ways that you can fine-tune this. But the big hidden feature here is, I'm going to just type something into my search box so I can bring up some kind of results, right? So if I just search for my name from the global,
I'm following along,
the global search box, what you're going to see is a bunch of stuff, and you're probably going to see emails come up first because it searches emails by default. You're going to see calendar items. You're going to see
fast, too.
Documents. Yeah, it's very fast. When you search from that search box, it's in the upper corner. It's instant. Search. If you have to do an advanced search where you're specifying different criteria, you actually have to click a search button to instantiate the search. But for purposes of this exercise, let's say we'll just use we'll just make a very basic search. Obviously, you can go in here and you can fine tune this however you want. What's interesting about this, and I think one of the goals of this eventually is what they want you to use, even though, again, it's quite hidden, is they want you to use this tagging feature where you can apply tags to documents, to pictures, to music files, whatever. Word and Excel and PowerPoint and those applications all actually have this built into the file save dialog. If you bring up a document in Word, click File Save As, you'll notice there's a way to tag that thing. And of course, the photo application that's built into Vista has this capability for photos. You can tag things in Windows Media Player if you want to tag music or video files, etc. There are ways to do this. It's just that it's not very, you know, seamless, unfortunately. They wanted it to be a lot more obvious than it was. So that's for the future. But for now, what you can do, and this is sort of the hidden feature of this, is you can actually save your search. And the way to do that is you have to bring up the file menu, which is hidden by default in Windows Vista. So if you just hit Alt, you'll see the file menu pops up. Hit F to bring that down. And the top item in there is Save Search. And this allows you to save a search folder. And a search folder is a dynamic folder. It's a virtual folder. It's a folder that is automatically populated by running a query, which in this case is just the search for my name. So this is every possible document type, every saved search location on my hard drive, which is typically, you know, your documents folders and some other locations under your user profile. And it's saved as a search folder by default in the searches folder, which is under your user profile. You could save it to your desktop. You can put it anywhere you want. And when you save that thing, you'll see it has a special blue icon with a magnifying glass on it. And you can open it up and you get those results. And it is instantaneous. And what's interesting about this, and unfortunately, because of the way it was implemented, it's not something that's going to be a huge deal for the short term. But I think looking forward, this is going to be a very big deal in the future, is it is instantaneous. And it's supplying you with these results that are, by definition, are from all over your hard drive. So in my case, I have 2,578 different items that somehow have my name in them. A lot of them are emails. But, you know, when you bring this thing up, it literally is instantaneous. So if you're working on a...
So, and that's if you search the indexed stuff as opposed to searching everything.
Oh, yeah.
That's when it's really
fast. And you don't want to go... Obviously, there's a performance penalty. You could index your entire hard drive if you wanted, but why would you do that? You're not typically going to save files in the Windows folder or in program.
So what do you index? Just the documents folder? Or?
Yeah, typically. And a few other locations. Usually, it's stuff that's under your user profile.
Yeah.
And I think the big use for this would be, you know, right now, if I was working on an article about, actually, I am working on an article about Server Core. So I have certain emails that are related to this. I have certain documents I've created. I have documents that I'm using as reference. I have links to web pages that are out on the internet, and they're all in a folder, you know, and that's one way of doing things. Well, actually, they're not all in the folder because the emails aren't in the folder, you know. Sometimes these things can be pulled from different locations. So I think for a project like this, where I'm writing an article, it would make sense to create a save search folder that would have links to the different document types, and you could basically access them from a single location, even though these things might be all over the place on my hard drive, right? The email would be in my email. The web links would be up in Internet Explorer. The documents would be in my documents folder somewhere in a references folder. So instead of manually copying all this stuff into one location, I could just create a save search and it gives me the same effect. But it maintains the sort of integrity of the underlying system because you're not having to move things around. It's where they are naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. Very cool. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the Google model as opposed to the Yahoo model, where you spend a lot of time in Yahoo, you spend a lot of time organizing into folders. In Google, it's just put everything, throw it all in a pile. And you find it.
Exactly.
And of course, tagging is a really great way to extend that.
And I think this is the big mental block. You know, the thing that we have to get over as users is, if we want to work in the system most efficiently, if you have certain documents that you're creating or accessing for this, you know, you have to remember that it's not just it's not just the file name or the document name or the document name and author. It's all, you know, you also might want to apply tags to the file.
Right. Very good. Now, I guess we should do a software pick and then wrap it up.
Alrighty.
What do you got for us?
You know, I just closed my documents. Let me find it again. I do know it's called Shadow Explorer.
Use search.
Yeah, I'll use search. I will use search. Let's use
Let's
search.
Let's see how fast that integrated search is.
Okay.
Come on.
Let me type. I'll type it in. Shadow Explorer. Dun, dun, dun. Dun. Oh, it actually, one of the things that came up was the application itself.
Ah. Wow, so that's interesting. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a shortcut to the application.
Right.
It allowed me to run it. So, it's an application called Shadow Explorer. It's basically a user interface for another hidden Vista feature called Shadow Copy. And this is the thing we've talked about a little bit. You know, as you create documents and edit documents in Windows Vista, it's actually making backups behind the scenes.
I've never really used that, but that's a I love that idea.
That's the thing. Nobody actually ever really uses it, but it's there and it's just kind of running in the background.
Right.
So, by the way, this application, if you want to check it out, is at shadowexplorer.com. And really what this is it's just a front end, you know, user interface so that you can browse around all of the backups that are available on the system. And then you can export them, you know, to your desktop, wherever. So if you want to go access a certain version of a file, typically a document, you can do it via this interface. You know, the way that you do this in Vista, you know, without this user interface, is you do it on a file-by-file basis. Mm-hmm. So you could right-click on a file, choose Properties, go to the Previous Versions tab, and then you should see, depending on how long the file's been around or how many times you might have changed it, you should see different versions available from that list. And then from there, you can, you know, have them come forward. So, for example, in my own system, the file where I create every day for WinInfo, there are five different versions of it, dating back to the beginning of the month. There are, you know, different shadow copies, two from yesterday, two from earlier this week, and one from last week.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I like it. Because, you know, exactly. I know they're there, and I guess in an emergency, that's when you would find it useful, but it's nice to know, you know, be able to look back.
Yeah. So, you know, it's there. This, in some ways, the Shadow Explorer application browses by date. So it really does give you a chance to go back in time on your system.
Yeah,
and then go look. In other words, you pick a date and you navigate around, you know, what the system looked like on that date. And you can see whatever files were available on that date as they were, you know, on that date.
Oh, very cool. Paul, some good stuff today, I tell you. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find Paul at the Supersite for Windows, winsupersite.com. His blog is there, and he sells off his old crap at internet-nexus.com.
I should mention, I haven't updated the Nexus in a while, and I'm actually not sure how I'm going to do the selling of my old crap, as you put it, going forward. I need to think about that. I actually, as part of a review for Office Live Small Business, I have gotten a new URL, and I might actually try to do it through there just because I need to test the site anyway. Yeah, I got to figure. I don't think we should do this on the podcast, but I do have some things I need to get rid of. So
okay, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in the future. So I need to figure out a way to do this, but we'll get that going again soon. I promise.
Very cool. And of course, his book Windows Vista Secrets with Brian Livingston is a really great Vista book. The Service Pack 1 version is on the way. I know.
Mm-hmm.
Look forward to that. And we'll be back next Thursday. We're gonna stun you all by actually making this a weekly show.
As per the name.
Paul Theroux, thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly.